Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith.
Started here. So hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. And occasionally we talk directly about fairies on this show. This is more of an arts and culture podcast, but I do like to include folklore when really interesting books come out that address it directly. And this book just came out back in 2023, I believe it was March, and it's from Cambridge University Press. And it is called Twilight of the Godlings. And today, then the subtitle is The Shadowy Beginnings of Britain's Supernatural Beings. And I have Dr. Francis Young, the author of the book, to discuss the book, discuss what fairies or godlings are, and just to discuss it and hopefully you'll clear up some confusing things that I had, you know, some questions I had, because I'm not an expert in this. So, Dr. Young, why don't you introduce yourself and give some background?
Hello. Well, I'm Francis Young. I'm a historian of religion and belief. I'm also a folklorist. So I work really across the history of what people believe, both the things that we might associate with traditional religion, but also the slightly more way out beliefs that lie outside the realm of religion. And that's where my interest in folklore comes from. I've been working in this area for, well, over a decade now. And it was the subject of my doctoral work as well, where I looked at English Catholics and supernatural beliefs. And so I'm very much interested in the interplay between religion and specifically Catholicism and other supernatural beliefs. And this book, Twilight of the Godlings, is really my attempt to reopen a discussion which hasn't really had much happening in it or anything substantial happening in it for about 50 years. And that's the discussion of where does British fairy belief come from?
Yeah, and see, you cover a lot of different beings in here, from hags to incubi to, you know, giants. You kind of touch on giants a little bit. Leprechauns even get kind of a mention in here. You kind of discuss the origins of leprechauns, which is very interesting. So what kind of brought this book on? How did you get Cambridge to publish a book on fairies? Like, is that something that they that they do? I mean, I think your more recent book, Magic in Merlin's Realm, was also from Cambridge, and you also got I forget the artist's name, but he illustrated Tolkien's.
Alan Lee.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Yes, and you got him to illustrate both the covers for that. So how did this kind of come about, and how did you get Alan Lee to participate?
Yeah, well, it wasn't easy to persuade Cambridge University Press to go down this road. And it was Magic in Merlin's Realm that was the first book that I had published with CUP, as it's known. It did take a bit of persuading. But after that book sold quite well, then they were more convinced, and they decided to go with Twilight of the Godlings. And it's a connection between the publisher that I work with and Alan Lee that he was willing to allow his illustrations to be used, which is wonderful because Alan Lee is one of the great British illustrators of fairies. There's a wonderful book which he created together with another illustrator, Brian Froud, in the 1970s, where the two of them went to Dartmoor for 6 weeks or some crazy length of time, and they holed up in a cottage in the middle of nowhere on Dartmoor and drew fairies. And I don't think they would ever admit whether they were just making them up or whether they were actually drawing fairies. But they certainly have this extraordinary reputation. And of course, yeah, Alan Lee's got this tremendous reputation as the illustrator of Tolkien who really kind of inspired Peter Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Therefore, he ended up working on the the set designs for the movies for Lord of the Rings. So yeah, that was a great privilege, I think, to have him as an illustrator.
Yeah, it's the covers are very, I mean, they're beautiful for both of them, and they're very striking. And I like how Magic and Merlin's Realm is blue and this one's green. You know, you had to come up with like a red one, and then, you know, I don't know, thematically they kind of fit together, you know. So I guess you kind of talk about folklore in your book, Twilight of the Godlings. I mean, it's all folklore, like you're pulling a lot from folklore, and then from archaeology and from other things like that. So what is folklore? You kind of described folklore as a modern concept. What do you mean by that?
Well, folklore as a term dates back only as recently as 1846. So there was a German scholar called Toms who came up with this phrase, and it then becomes adopted by the Folklore Society in London, which is the first organization devoted to collecting and analyzing folklore. Before that, though, folklore did exist, but it was known by another term, which is popular antiquities. And so when you look at what somebody like John Aubrey was doing in the 17th century, going around the English countryside, collecting stories that people had, it's basically the same as folklore. Hmm. But for me, I mean, I am a folklorist, so some of what I write is folklore. But for me, this is not really a book about folklore in the conventional sense, because it's not just collecting what people have said about a particular legend or a particular custom or whatever, which is what folklore does. Folklore is a very non-judgmental discipline. You know, essentially what you're about is collecting, either from living people, or often these days, especially in the UK, you're collecting from obscure published sources of the past, which haven't been noticed before, and gathering together and so forth. And I have done that in the past, but this is really trying to get back to a much more distant past. And I think this is something that folklorists have become a bit reluctant to do, because it requires getting a bit more speculative.
Yeah.
And folklorists are not always willing. They want to stay kind of in what they've got evidence for from living people or from quite recently, you know, recently collected material.
Well, I think part of the fun of folklore is speculation, you know. You know, how do these things fit together? How do these beings kind of interact with each other? So it's kind of very interesting. So you describe a concept, and I'm not going to pronounce it correctly because I am from Minnesota, and we have a right of mispronouncing everything. The long durée, is that correct?
Yes, that's perfect.
Oh, look at that. Yeah. Wow. All right. So what is the long durée, and how does it factor into your book? And then compare it. So there's another hypothesis. So that's kind of your hypothesis. And then there's of what these beings are. And then there's the survivalist hypothesis. So how do those two things compare to one another?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure I'd describe the long durée as a hypothesis.
Okay.
I would say it's kind of a style of doing history, an approach. It's basically the idea that some features of human culture, many features of human culture, in fact, don't change hugely over time. Or if they do, they remain essentially the same in structure, in form, in function. And therefore, it's possible to study them over very long periods of time. Now, how that works in this particular case is that I make the argument that belief in godlings, that is to say, this sort of subordinate class of deities that are neither human nor truly divine, seems to be something which we see in human societies. And here I'm using the particular example of Britain, but this would apply more generally. Excuse me. That this is something which we see across human societies over long periods of time. So my attempt is to tell this particular story for Britain, going from a period which kind of begins with just before the Roman invasion, so sort of the late Iron Age, going right the way through to the English Reformation. Now, this is not something that people would normally attempt. So normally, historians work with less ambitious frameworks of chronology. I think because we tend to see certain eras as discrete periods, so, you know, somebody might study fairy belief in the early modern period or fairy belief in the Middle Ages, Or they might be a classicist, and they might then study ancient Roman belief in deities of nature or something like that. And they might see all those things as discrete studies, which can't be joined together. And I have tried to join them together speculatively. But this is different from the survivalist hypothesis that you mentioned. So the survivalist hypothesis is something which becomes popular in the 19th century, although you can find traces of it before that. But it's the idea that when you encounter things like belief in fairies, or indeed any kind of folklore, it represents a very, very ancient survival of some pagan belief going back to immemorial antiquity, which has been transmitted down to the present day, but in a degraded form. Mm-hmm. So it usually is accompanied by this idea of degradation or decay. And so, for example, you'll have Victorian folklorists saying that when people believe in Robin Goodfellow, who is a domestic spirit, you know, who tidies your house for you in English folklore, and indeed similar beings in Scottish folklore, like the Brownie, this is some kind of relic of the Lares and Penates of ancient Rome, that it's been gradually diminished and passed down. Now, this, I think, is something which has been largely discredited because there's insufficient evidence for it.
Right.
But what I'm saying is a bit more nuanced than that. I'm saying that it's not the same beings. It's not as though when people believe in fairies in the 19th century, they are believing in the same beings as their Roman or their Anglo-Saxon predecessors. But I'm saying that they're believing in the same kind of beings. So it's more like the species is, if you like, a survival rather than the individuals or the names or the specific traditions.
Yeah. Well, that was the most fascinating, you know, part of your book, is this idea the human cultures have similar tendencies, and that we will perceive, and you know, you can always correct me if I understand this incorrectly, but we perceive these beings in a similar way, but they're not necessarily the same, like, not the same being. And it's like, there's also this theory that you kind of, I think it was debunked, probably, I think it's been debunked by now, that up until the 19th century, the English peasant class was, they're secretly pagan. They retained a bunch of pagan traditions, and it was the aristocracy who, you know, were Christians imposing it on people. Is that's kind of similar, I think, where it's like all these pagan practices survived, but they're hidden. But that's not really what's going on. It's like this human nature is the same, you know, and so we perceive these beings in a similar way that the Romans did, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think, yeah, you're right to draw that comparison with the view of, the kind of the hidden paganism that used to be believed to exist and still informs popular culture. And if people still think that Morris dancing or something like that is actually a pagan tradition. And of course it's not. It's something which is late medieval. But it is nevertheless true to say that, you know, kind of rural festival culture, the importance of the passing of the seasons, mm-hmm. the importance of cosmological events like the equinoxes and the solstices and so forth, these are things that mattered to medieval Christians, but they are also things that mattered to their pagan predecessors. And so there is a human link in history that joins us to our pagan predecessors, even if nothing survives of paganism. As you say, we're all human. So there are certain commonalities. And I think one of the human tendencies is the tendency to believe that beings exist, possibly even the necessity to believe that beings exist that are somehow intermediate between us and the divine realm. Mm-hmm. And this is where the godlings come in.
Yeah, and C.S. Lewis in his Discarded Image talks about them too, and he called them the longevity, because he said that if he used the word fairies, people would have all these misconceptions about fairies being like little Tinkerbell sort of figures, when really they were these rather terrifying, ambiguous like morally ambiguous, as well as sexually ambiguous, and you get into that too, like the numbers and their sexuality and their morality are all ambiguous, right? That's kind of their defining feature. Yeah. But I think Lewis said their unimportance kind of shows their importance, you know, because they couldn't quite fit into the medieval model. And so that they kind of introduced this wild aspect. So that very interesting. And then, so you approach God. So we kind of talked about what godlings are. We can maybe expand on that more. But your approach to the godlings in this book is interesting because you said you're not merely seeking rational explanations. You are engaging with these beings as experiential and cultural realities. Can you go into more about what you mean by that?
Well, I think there's an approach to folklore and an approach to supernatural belief, which we still sometimes encounter among scholars, which is to say, let's try and explain this. Yeah. In other words, let's try to explain this away. Let's try to account for this. And, you know, the most extreme examples of that, you've got people who say, you know, witchcraft panics in early modern Europe were caused by ergot poisoning, and everything can be explained by means right. of, you know, some kind of chemical imbalances in people's bodies due to diet and things like that. And all this sort of stuff. And I think there are, you know, there are more or less sophisticated versions of this, but I don't really like that approach to history, which I would refer to as reductivism. In other words, you're trying to reduce it to something which is easier to explain. Functionalism would be another approach to that. So you try and say, well, people believed in these beings because they had some kind of need, and therefore we need to establish what that need was for them to believe in it. But I think that is kind of doing a disservice to our ancestors and, mm-hmm. and doing a disservice to medieval and early modern people, because they had their own reasons for believing in these beings, which weren't necessarily the same for every person or every community. And the important thing, when you quoted the bit about experiential realities, that people experienced these beings as real to the point that they incorporated them without question into their perception of reality, their framework of what reality is. And I think that's something we should respect. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it affected the way that they behaved. And that means that as a historian, if I want to understand, you know, people's behavior in the past and analyze events in the past, that behavior and those events will be informed by the conviction that people had that these things were real and that then, you know, therefore behaved accordingly. So, yeah, I don't see any point really of kind of engaging in these, you know, kind of overreaching speculations about, you know, what was real, what was not, how we can, you know, how we can explain this and explain that, because to me that's not the interesting question.
Right. Right, it's imposing a 21st century view on history. Like we're going to explain all this weird stuff away because it's weird. You know, we can't account for it. So it had to be, you know, a fungus messing with people's brain chemistry, or they're lying, or something like that. You know, where it's not a very good way to do history at all, just in general. You know, to say, well, clearly this didn't happen. Clearly, you know, that this abbot, he couldn't have experienced, you know, three beautiful women, you know, playing musical instruments or whatever. It couldn't have been, it had to have been a trick of the light or something, you know. So it's a very, do you run into pushback on that approach?
Occasionally, but I think that there is generally kind of, certainly among scholars in my field, I think there's general acceptance that this is an acceptable approach.
Interesting, yeah.
There's general acceptance that this is an acceptable approach, that you can, it's a kind of suspension of disbelief, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we can engage with people in the past on their own terms. But I also think that we have no particular right to impose a 21st century materialist outlook on people in the past, or to assume that such an outlook is somehow normative. I don't see any justification to that at all.
Well, that's surprisingly more open than I would have thought, but I think things are changing. You know, I think the culture, we're getting more and more open to, I mean, we have open discussions about concepts like egregores and you know you know, weird, crazy things like that, where it's like, okay, this is, it's getting kind of weird out there, but people are more open to these sorts of approaches and these sorts of discussions, which I think is it can be both alarming and inspire hope. You know, people aren't just basic materialists. The general culture does, in America, we believe, I mean, probably in England too, ghosts and UFOs are very, a lot of people, and I believe in ghosts at least. I have different theories as to what they are, but a lot of people believe in UFOs. A lot of people believe, people aren't the base level, they're not materialists necessarily, you know. It's becoming more and more popular, I should say, I guess.
It's interesting how these beliefs, though, they're sort of coded in particular ways that are acceptable or unacceptable. So certainly in the UK, belief in ghosts is bordering on acceptable.
Yeah.
Whereas as soon as you start talking about fairies, people might start laughing. and yet there's no obvious and universally agreed way in which belief in ghosts is less absurd or more absurd than belief in fairies.
Right.
I don't really see that. And so it's kind of, it goes back to something that you said earlier about the cultural associations that certain words provoke. Mm-hmm. And the word fairy is one of those words. And, you know, that's part of the reason why I use godling in the title of the book and throughout the book. Not the only reason. I mean, the other reason, I think, is because it allows a much broader consideration of this category of supernatural beings, which I think is genuinely larger mm-hmm. than the word fairy allows us to make it, because this word fairy, you know, is a fairly late import from French into the English language. And before that, the word elf was, you know, much more universal. And of course, the sense of what elf meant is something which Tolkien explores in a fictional context, but that's grounded within his study and understanding of the Anglo-Saxon sources about elves, which are very mysterious but nevertheless tantalizing.
Right. Yeah, they fairies definitely elicit a certain response. And so if you say you believe in fairies, then people might think that you think that the little Tinkerbell butterfly creatures, you know, that's ridiculous. And that's partly why the show is called I Might Believe in Fairies, because it's more like being open to, and I'm a Catholic, so I'm very Orthodox Catholic, but you know, these things, being open to just the weirdness and craziness of you know, God's creation, I guess. So just being open to those things, not necessarily just, you know, uncritically accepting everything, but being open to it. And I think a lot of people are becoming more and more open, as we've kind of discussed. If you phrase that, do you believe in godlings or spirits of the forest or spirits of the waters, you know, people might give you a different answer, you know, than do you believe in fairies, right? So, because if, like, some ghost stories and some fairy stories and some, you know, as you've kind of discussed in here, some like stories about saints and demons, they all kind of have similar themes and a similar feel to them, I guess, where I think you mentioned in there that some of the saints, like some of their more folkloric stories, they tend to come off as more harsh, you know, and maybe they were, but they're saint stories and fairy tales have a certain similarity to them. Do you think you could kind of, I know that's kind of a broad question, but do you think you could expand on that? You didn't get into it a ton in the book, but you did mention it.
Yeah, I think it is a fruitful line for further investigation, the extent to which saints to some extent take over from fairies. I mean, an argument that I make in the book is that the reason godlings survive as a feature of belief is because people still require them. And that's because Christianity, when it arrives, you know, contrary to, you know, a lot of people will have a view that Christianity just comes in like a bulldozer and suppresses everything. And that really isn't true. Yeah. That's not the way that it works.
It's not true.
In Europe. And Christianity reaches those parts of people's lives that it needs to. So in other words, a society in the early Middle Ages is going to be as Christianized as it needs to be. I recently coined it in another book that I'm writing. I coined a term for this sort of, with apologies to C.S. Lewis, mere Christianization, which is sort of the idea that you kind of, you Christianize the ruler, you Christianize, you know, basic aspects of political ritual, you Christianize people by baptizing them and so forth, but you leave other stuff alone for quite some time. So, for example, rites of betrothal and marriage, mm-hmm. funeral rites, things like that, you know, they carry on long after the sacrifices have been suppressed. And another example is these godlings, because they don't have temples, they don't have cults, they don't have priests, they are not gods, they're not deities in the pagan sense. But they are beings that people believe in as a way of making sense of the natural world and its unpredictability. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a subsistence farmer trying to, you know, get by in, you know, 7th century Gaul or something like that, the church is great when it comes to answering the ultimate questions of life, but hasn't yet penetrated that far into your life. But over time, it does. And so the saints, the rural saints, the local saints, they take on that role and they become these beloved protectors and beloved givers of help and assistance, mm-hmm. who do kind of take on that role. And so I think that there absolutely is a connection there with the fact that the saints, especially after their death, the saints will often change their behavior. Mm-hmm. So even if during their life, they might have been renowned for gentleness, after their deaths, they will sometimes become quite vengeful and right. brutal. And this is something which we find in fairy justice. You know, fairies have a very strongly developed sense of justice, but it's kind of untempered by mercy. And so there's that sense in which they exercise a very brutal, very, very primal kind of justice, but also can reward disproportionately as well in response to how people behave towards them. And you find the same kind of thing with regard to saints.
Yeah, and I think that was a fascinating part of the book, because when a society becomes Christianized, it takes a while for all those, I think you described them as like, they're almost like ecological niches, you know, niches, yeah. where they, and I'm a biologist by training, nature abhors a vacuum, right? So every aspect of the society needs to be accounted for somehow. And the different aspects, if there's no immediate Christianization of that aspect of society, whether it be farming or like the mountains or rivers and streams, then that sort of need will still be there. And so it'll be populated by nymphs or fawns or, you know, something similar until there is a suitable replacement, I guess. From a Christian perspective, you know, it's fascinating because they're not necessarily portrayed. I mean, they're often portrayed as antagonistic, right? But it's not always the case. And one thing that really struck me was the penitential literature that you were citing from, where you have whoever's writing it, an abbot or whoever, a priest, was saying, okay, well, if you offer a sacrifice if you pour out a libation to the Faunus or Pan, that's, 8 years of penance, you know, and then you reference like, well, that doesn't necessarily reflect what the actual beliefs were on, you know, just for a day-to-day person, you know? So it's, that was really interesting. Like, how do we know that what he's writing about actually occurred, you know?
This is really tricky. There's a famous one, which is the penitential of Bartholomew Ascanus, Bishop of Exeter. This is in the 12th century. Most of the penitentials that we have are not from Britain. They're from Gaul and Iberia. But there's a couple from Britain, mm-hmm. that mention supernatural beliefs. But as you say, it's very difficult to know, is this bishop simply kind of copying a document which has been received from another bishop?
Yeah.
And therefore it's kind of good practice, if you like. a bit like in companies where, you know, people are constantly making new policy documents, and so they'll borrow one from a colleague and copy and paste to make sure that they've covered all their bases. And it might be a similar kind of thing going on here. And so it's difficult to know, is this something that really is happening in 12th century Devon and Cornwall, where this diocese is located, or is it something that's been brought in, and that the practice that's recorded is people throwing miniature toys and weapons into barns and granaries so that the fawns can play with them. And it's such a bizarre practice that my view is probably is something that people were doing.
Yeah.
Because it's too weird to have been made up.
Right.
And that's, you know, sometimes when you're studying in my field, you sometimes have to ask yourself this question. Is this so weird? It's kind of got to be true, because it doesn't seem to be something that's just been transmitted. Whereas other stuff, it's so similar to continental penitentials. You have to say, well, yeah, probably it's just been put in there because it was inherited in that scribal tradition.
Right. Well, that a number of times I was reading this, especially when it like giving gifts and things to the helpful spirits of the home or whatever, it reminded me of the story of the elves and the shoemaker, you know, where the elves would come in and make all of his shoes for him, and he became exceedingly wealthy until they decided, you know, we're going to thank them. And so he and his wife made little clothes and gave them to the elves, and then they put them on and disappeared, right? It's like Dobby from Harry Potter, you know, he's giving, you know, he gave him a sock and he's free because he gets human clothes or whatever. So is that pulling from that sort of tradition of like you throw the toys in the granary? Or
it's especially interesting to me, this mention of the miniature toys and weapons, because we do in archaeology actually find these miniature toys and weapons,
mm-hmm.
but we find them in the context of votive offerings that are made in, for example, Roman shrines, where in the magical logic of pagan sacrifice, you just need to give a copy of the thing that you're offering.
Mm.
Because in the divine realm, they don't really bother about whether it's real or not. It's more about the intent with which it's made, or something like that.
That seems
to be the thing behind it. And so hence you get the offering of models and miniatures at votive shrines. So it's intriguing to think that maybe what's going on there when you have the giving of these little weapons is something which is inherited from the Roman past. And that's a theme which I constantly come back to in the book, is there some kind of link we can establish between Roman religion, Romano-British religion, during the period when Britain is part of the Roman Empire, and some of these later beliefs that we find. And ultimately, I draw a blank to the point that I can't say with certainty
mm-hmm.
that there's anything that we can link. But I think there are some fascinating bits of circumstantial evidence, like, you know, the miniature weapons.
Yeah, I think you described that whole time period as an epistemological black box. It just because it's so... I quoted in my notes, you have a quote from your book, the idea that the building blocks of British folklore emerged in the post-Roman twilight of early medieval Britain is in and of itself uncontroversial. But it is an assertion often presented as an epistemological black box. Romano-Celtic and Germanic beliefs went in, and somehow fairly familiar supernatural and folkloric beings came out. So why is it a black box?
I think because it's a phase in a causal chain, which we assume to be there, but we don't know what was going on inside the box. Mm-hmm. And so it's rather like when you get diagrams in electronics that sort of show everything going into a black box, and, you know, no, but it doesn't explain what actually is happening to cause the change in the black box. And it's the same kind of idea. I think, you know, the it's sometimes, you know, referred to as the Arthurian period,
mm-hmm.
sometimes referred to as the Dark Ages, but this period after the fall of the Roman Empire, but before the appearance of the Anglo-Saxon culture in its fullness, is this fascinating period, because we know it's formative. It has to be formative, because everything must have come out of it in order to create those subsequent cultures and literatures, because you've got the Anglo-Saxon literature, you've got the Welsh literature, like the Mabinogion coming out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, indeed, the Irish literature coming out of that, because the conversion of Ireland to Christianity takes place during that period as well.
Right.
So it's absolutely crucial for Britain and Ireland. But we are without historical sources, apart from one or two lights in the darkness, like Patrick, who writes his Confessio, and Gildas, who writes the De Exigio Britanniae, which is this unique kind of account of bad things, disasters happening in post-Roman Britain. But yeah, it seems that there was this kind of melting pot of beliefs, including Christianity. But Christianity, while it survives in the west of the country, survives in Wales, in Cornwall, and so forth, it seems that Christianity doesn't survive in the areas that come to be speaking the old English language, the Anglo-Saxon areas. And so you've got this sort of melting pot of cultures, but also this frontier of cultures where the Britons and the Anglo-Saxons are interacting, and Christianity must be interacting with paganism as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just don't know that much about it. It's mostly because we don't have writing from that period, right? That's the whole, yeah. Because the Roman Empire fell, and then things kind of took a turn, you know. So one of the big parts of your book is the idea that the church fathers influenced like belief and folklore in their depictions of these beings. So how did they, that was a very interesting turn. I wasn't, you know, it's not that the church fathers are not something you necessarily think of when you think of folklore, but there are stories like the story of St. Anthony, I think it was St. Paul. I always forget who it is, but it's St. Anthony. He meets a faun, and he meets a centaur. There's a story about him, and you mentioned that in the book. So how do the church fathers influence the depiction of these beings?
Yeah, it is a surprising connection, I think. But the important thing to bear in mind about the church fathers in this period is that they are the stream through which knowledge of the Roman world, knowledge of the ancient world, is actually mediated to most medieval people.
Mm-hmm.
Because most medieval people are not getting their knowledge directly from Roman literature. You know, most of that is being copied in monasteries in Italy or wherever, where it's not being widely read. But the texts that are being widely read are, of course, the Bible and commentaries on the Bible. The Bible, of course, being in the Vulgate translation by Jerome,
mm-hmm.
Jerome's commentaries being very influential upon that. And there are certain translation choices that Jerome makes, or at least choices that he comments upon in his commentaries, which are quite significant. So, for example, when he's talking about statyrs, for which he tends to use the term pelosi, which means hairy ones,
mm-hmm.
In reference to, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so I can't explain what the original reference exactly is, but some kind of goat demons that pop up in some of the prophetic books, certainly in Isaiah. And they are translated as satyrs or pelosi, these hairy ones. They then come to be translated in Old English as wuduasa or woodwoes in later Middle English. And that, of course, gives rise to this idea of the man of the woods, this hairy being covered completely in hair. Although it seems that Jerome was thinking of something more along the lines of fauns.
Yeah.
So that's one example. And then another example is Isidore of Seville. Now, Isidore of Seville, great saint of the 7th century, encyclopedist, who effectively produces these epitomes of ancient learning. Epitomes being summaries, basically, because this is a time when books are very, very expensive. Most people don't have access to all of the books. And so if your monastery, your newly founded monastery, wants one book that kind of gives you a one-stop shop, all the knowledge of the ancient world, or at least what you need of it, Isidore of Seville's Etymologies, great place to start. He is, in fact, the patron saint of encyclopedia writers and anybody who puts together reference works and things like that. And this stuff is very detailed when it comes to godlings. You know, so he's got stuff there about fauns and satyrs and nymphs. He's got stuff about the souls of heroes. He's got stuff about giants. So, you know, everything is in there, which you can see then has this kind of profound influence on early medieval thought, because Isidore is one of the people who is most definitely read. Mm-hmm. So take Beowulf, for example. When you've got the introduction of the figure of Grendel, Grendel is said to be descended from Cain. So mm-hmm. this biblical explanation is given for how the mark of Cain has made Cain's descendants progressively more monstrous and turned them into things like orcs and ogres and giants and elves and so forth. But within this list, you've got certain terms that are derived from Latin, like, you know, gigants, which is from gigantes, you know, yeah. the giant ones. So clearly there's this kind of mingling of kind of biblical etiologies, biblical accounts of how monstrous and supernatural beings came into being, with these ancient ideas of where they might have come from as well. And you find it again in Geoffrey of Monmouth, where when Brutus the Trojan arrives and finds Britain inhabited by the giants of Albion, well, there's a sort of pseudo-biblical explanation of that they're the giants who had survived the flood. But of course, there aren't supposed to be any giants that survived the flood. But the reality is that, yeah, what you're probably more looking at is a conception of giants from Isidore of Seville, you know, from the church fathers. Mm-hmm. And so this, yeah, all this learning becomes, yeah, all sort of merged in a, I don't want to say a confusion, but a very variable tradition
yeah.
of how you interpret this kind of fringe stuff, fringe phenomena, if you like.
Well, it goes to what we were talking about before. The church fathers had a perspective that they brought to these beings, you know, from their classical educations and stuff like that. And they said, oh, like with Jerome, the hairy ones, oh, those are obviously something like, you know, satyrs. And so that's what he uses, or Pelosi, you know, that's what he pulls from. And that's it made sense, you know, to him. And it reminds me, there's I don't know if you've ever read any Manly Wade Wellman. He's an American pulp author, and he's got a book about werewolves called The Hairy Ones Shall Dance. And it's a reference to Isaiah, and it's about, you know, werewolves. And that's, he connects the werewolves to that line in Isaiah. It's kind of beside the point, but it's interesting. So yeah, that's, and I think you mentioned Saint Augustine as well. I don't remember what, I think it was something about the incubi, I think, or succubi, or
yeah,
something
the
like
Ducii,
that.
Or Ducii.
Mm. Oh yeah, yeah.
This is one where Augustine says that in Gaul there are these beings called Ducii who seduce women, mm-hmm. And that feeds into the kind of the medieval incubus tradition. Although incubus itself derives from the Latin word incubo, which is one of the titles of the god Faunus. Mm, so there mm-hmm. you've got a conflation of two different traditions. But yeah, it's difficult to find any evidence that these Ducii that Augustine writes about, that people in Gaul actually did believe in them. Mm-hmm. But of course, the tradition became so influential because Augustine had said it,
right.
that therefore, it's almost as though Augustine brings them into being, because people do start believing in them.
Right.
So Bede, for example, writes about them and tells stories about women who had been seduced in the countryside by these roving spirits. And this, it becomes quite a big feature of English tradition with regard to other world beings, that you're at risk if you're alone in the countryside of being, you know, seduced by these beings who might take on the form of beautiful men or women.
Right. Right. Well, I think you had mentioned about the Ducii that it might just be a general term for like unclean spirit, that St. Augustine then put a capital D in front of it and said, this is a specific class of beings, you know, that are in Gaul. But really maybe he was just, you know, he is just referencing unclean spirits, but thinking that they're somehow distinct. It's interesting how we're getting this kind of all this is filtered through the church fathers. I just thought that was absolutely fascinating. And so another kind of filter that gets applied later on that you reference is romance literature, and how that influences folklore, and how folklore influences, you know, romance literature. So just describe what romance literature is. I think people have misconceptions about that. It's not like, you know, the bodice ripping sort of stuff you find in the bookstore. Just describe what that is and how it kind of influenced folklore.
So romance literature is a type of vernacular literature. So in other words, not written in Latin, but written in the languages that people actually spoke, that arises from the 12th century onwards in northern France and Brittany and Normandy and that sort of area. And it involves long poems and prose poems, which tend to take place in the universe of King Arthur's court, mm-hmm. to a greater or lesser extent. So the chivalric universe of the Knights of the Round Table, ironically set in Britain, even though the tradition begins in France.
Right.
But there may well be a connection with Brittany, the fact that it comes out of this area, which, you know, was traditionally British in the sense of British speaking, speaking a language, Breton, similar to Welsh. They are basically stories which often involve supernatural characters and elements. And the concept of fairy comes out of these romances. So fairy is the realm of these beings that have the capacity to spin the fates of men. So the word fae, related to Latin fata, the things uttered, the speech, if you like, determining destiny, the speech of the gods. And that turns into figures like Morgan Le Fay is probably the most notable example. But these aren't fairies in any way that we would understand them in popular culture now. They are grand ladies, beautiful ladies, like the Lady of the Lake, who are in possession of magical objects, who can affect the fates of heroes. You know, a cynical interpretation is that they're a bit like a deus ex machina, you know, in literary mm-hmm. terms. They're sort of what you would, if you can't quite work out where the story's going, let's introduce this magical lady who is in possession of a magical cauldron that resurrects warriors or something. So it's a way of keeping the story going. Mm-hmm. And one of the debates about romance literature is the extent to which this actually reflects what people believed. You know, did people really believe there was a Lady of the Lake? Did people really believe that Morgan Le Fay, had these powers and so forth? Or is this a kind of literary tradition? So it's a bit like if you were to, be excavating the 20th century and the only books that you could find were the Harry Potter books.
Right, yeah.
You might read those and you say, oh, people of the, you know, late 20th, early 21st century believed in hereditary wizards. this was their belief. And of course, that would be nonsense. And I think it's a bit like that with the romances, just because that's something which a writer chose to use to represent magic or to represent fairies doesn't necessarily mean that people actually believe that.
Right.
But on the other hand, it does tell us the parameters of the sort of things that people were willing to believe, the sort of things that people were willing to have their beliefs suspended over. So I think it's kind of, it's difficult evidence to use for what people believed, but nevertheless very interesting in terms of telling us about their imaginations and what they were capable of imagining.
Right. Well, it's the book. Canticle for Leibowitz. There's a scene where this kind of secular scholar comes in and he's going through the medieval library, you know, or not a medieval library. It's a post-apocalyptic library in this, abbey. And he finds this. It basically amounts to a bit of Lovecraft's fiction. Right. And he's like, oh, see, look. Before there was humans, there were these gods that that used people for food and, you know, there's no Christian God. That's all fake. This is what the truth is. And then and he's reading it as literal fact, you know, but it's just a piece of fiction. And then the abbot, he's like, no, that's a bit of imaginative fluff, you know? And so it's very similar to that where it's like, yeah, if all we had left were the Harry Potter books, that wouldn't give us an accurate depiction of what people believed, you know. But I like the way you phrased, you explained that it gave us kind of their Overton window of what they were willing to believe, what was possible, you know, what was kind of what they were willing to suspend their disbelief over. So I think that is useful. And I think the Harry Potter books would probably serve this a similar purpose too, in other fiction like that. So yeah, that's very interesting. And you'd mentioned the Lady of the Lake and Morgan Le Fay tied to fate, and fairies as tied to the fate of men. And the word fairy, means fate. So when did that association arise, and have they always been kind of associated with fates? Cause you have like the Furies and then the Norns, yeah, and, you know, all of those different, triplicate women, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And this idea of three women who in some way are responsible for fate and will often be engaged in the activity of spinning, or winding out a string of some kind. This does seem to be a theme which is common to Indo-European cultures. So I'm quite skeptical often of this sort of stuff, it's across all cultures. In this case, I think the evidence is quite strong to suggest that it is. Mm-hmm. So we find it in Norse culture with the Norns, who are the weird sisters, W-Y-R-D, who occur in Scottish folklore and then find their way, of course, into Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Right.
Where they are often, these days people just say, oh, they're witches. Actually, no, they're not. They are not human. They're not human.
Right.
So they're not witches in the way that we would understand.
Well, and it's interesting, especially those characters, that Shakespeare depicts them as sexually ambiguous as well. They have beards. You know, they look like old women, but they have beards. And I think one of the characters references that, the fact that they are ambiguous. And so that ties into, the nature of these godlings as well. But please continue.
Yeah, so you've got the Norns. You've got the Parcae, who are the Roman equivalent. So they are these fates who spin people's fates through spinning. And then you've got probably the best known iteration of this, which would be the Moirai, who are the Greek version of this. But we find this triplicity of women occurring again and again all over the place. So we find the Gallo-Celtic mother goddesses, who are these three goddesses. We don't know what their names were, but they often occur in Roman Britain, very often worshipped. There seems to be this worship of a group of divine women. We find again in Anglo-Saxon belief that the Burgrunnen, who seem to be the same as the Parcae or more broadly similar, who determine fates. They don't have a cult. They don't have temples. They don't have priests. They are very much godlings. And I would say that if we were to pick out characteristics of what godlings are, yes, they're all the things that I've already said that they are, that they're, neither human nor divine, and have this kind of ambiguous status. But they tend to be associated with fate. And because they're associated with fate, they tend to be associated with children. Because, of course, the fate of a human being is determined in folk belief at the moment or shortly after the moment of that being's birth. So, today we would associate fairies with children. And that is an ancient association that goes way, way back. But it's not necessarily in a good way that they're associated with children, because they might, of course, be doing something bad or saying something bad, which causes the child to have a bad fate, if you like. Mm-hmm. They're associated with nature. So they're very much associated with living things, but also with the earth. And particularly with the idea of living under the earth. So the association between godlings and mounds, something you can find throughout European cultures, not just in Britain, all over the place. They somehow inhabit a realm which is accessed through hills or mounds, and they're located under the earth.
Well, yeah. And that also kind of, the fact that they're under the earth, ties into their demonization to an extent, right? Where they're kind of associated with the demonic, but then with the romance literature, they're kind of, undemonized. I forget the term you use in your book, but they
say, yeah, undemonized.
Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. and they're kind of, they're not tamed, but they're made more maybe acceptable. And they're not like depicted as necessarily evil, just, you can't trust them still, but they're not necessarily demons. And so, yeah, that's the whole triplicate women thing is, and women are also like abstract concepts are often portrayed as female, you know, which is, I don't know what to make of that either. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, like the fates and like fortune, you know, and all of these abstract concepts are portrayed as female, especially in the ancient world.
Yeah, well, one theory about the name, about the fairy name and its relationship with Fata, is that the cult of the Parcae, or belief in the Parcae, was suppressed in Roman Gaul or late Roman Christian Gaul. And therefore, people turned their attention, since they were no longer able to speak about the Parcae, almost as a euphemism, they would speak about the words of the Parcae. So they would talk about the Fata, the things uttered, the things that the Parcae said. And those Fata then became personified. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're talking about the process of personification, which we see in things like Lady Luck.
Right.
You know, if you go to Las Vegas, you've got loads of people for whom Lady Luck is very real. This idea of, you know, they believe so powerfully in the idea of luck as a real thing that they've kind of turned it into a belief in a person who has taken on substantial reality for them. And a similar kind of thing perhaps is happening with this personification of the Fata. And then the Fata become, you know, gradually the fae and the fairies. So that, you know, we don't have any evidence for that, but that is one possible trajectory that this is going down in a time when we have no written records for it.
Well, with that example of Lady Luck, that's when you're you know, what you're going for in your book, that's when it kind of clicked into place, because you have Fortuna, it's Fortuna, right? The Lady of Fortune, like the God of Fortune, and she's a goddess, and you have Lady Luck, and it's fulfilling the same role, but they're no one could say they're the same being, right? They're related because they're about the same thing, but they're not the same. Like, they emerged from different places. There really isn't a connection between them other than the role they play, right? So it's that's when it kind of clicked, when you gave that example, like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. This human need to kind of, you know, fill all these niches with beings, right? And we have this tendency to do that, and it's fascinating to me. That was a great example in the book of how that process works, like a modern example that people do. You know, I've never been to Las Vegas or anything like that. I'm just a good Minnesota boy. I don't gamble or anything. That's a very, very, very good example there. And there's, you know, there's a lot in your book that you covered. One of the interesting things was the pygmy theory of the godlings. Now, Arthur Machen, I always mispronounce his last name. He has a number of stories, I think, that deal with that. I think, what was the one? You're a fan of Machen. I can't remember the name of the story.
The one of the Black Seal.
Yeah, it could be. Not that one. It's, he's got a couple of them that deal with you know, this subterranean, you know, forgotten race of people. So where did the pygmy theory of the godlings come in, and is there anything to it?
Yeah, the pygmy theory, the earliest reference I've been able to find to it goes back to the 17th century. And it's the idea that it's basically that fairy stories can be explained away because at some point in the distant past, there was a relic population of an earlier people who were of a lower technological level than the new people who were coming in to replace them.
Mm-hmm.
And that relic population were therefore forced into to take to the hills, from which they would occasionally emerge in order to steal children from the dominant group, or to carry off their women or whatever. And that this became a race memory of a group of diminutive people who gradually became perceived as more and more magical, who became the fairies. And this is something which in the 19th century it takes off. And there's a guy called David McCritchie, who's a Scottish folklorist, who's absolutely convinced this is true. Mm-hmm. Lewis Spence, another person who's very, very keen on this, sometimes referred to as the euhemerist hypothesis, because like Euhemerus, the Greek mythographer who tried to explain everything about the gods in terms of them having once been real humans.
Okay. Yeah.
So these people like McRitchie and Spence try to explain that, yeah, the fairies were once real. And this is a race memory, for example, of Stone Age people who were driven into the hills by people using metal. That's the reason why the fairies are afraid of iron, of course.
Ah, of course, yeah.
And so they find this kind of convenient. But in this rather Victorian way where your explanation is just a bit too neat because you've managed to fit all the information you could possibly have wanted to into this. And I think it's also, you know, today we would look at this askance as a rather kind of racialist approach to folklore in that it seems to be kind of making an absolute distinction between human races, which, you know, is very much of its era and not something that people would subscribe to today. So I think, yeah, it's been discredited, but it was very dominant for a while.
Well, you referenced Sir Walter Scott, you know, talking about it in one of his essays on, I think on fairies. And Arthur Machen kind of plays with that idea as well in his stories. Not all of them. He's got, you know, other ones that have different theories as to what, like, you know, I think the great god Pan is a good example of, you know, a godling that is not a pygmy, obviously a very demonic, evil godling, right? So I just thought I would just kind of ask if there's anything, like, to that theory. I know that it's largely been discredited. I guess I'll ask a few more questions, but we're kind of wrapping up here. So you have your romance literature, you have the church fathers, you have, classical influences, and you have like the Norman influences, you have all these things you result in what you call a fairy synthesis in medieval England. So what does that synthesis look like? And what are all the things that kind of went into that?
Yeah. So I take the book up to around about 1500. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I stop there is because, of course, if we go any further, we run into the Reformation. And the Reformation has a profound effect on British folk belief, because obviously the Protestant reformers take a much stricter view of what is acceptable Christian belief and what's not, compared to sort of the popular Catholicism that previously existed. So really, I'm interested in establishing what was it that if you'd wandered into an English village around 1500 and asked people about fairies, what they would have told you. And what they probably would have told you is that there's a king and queen of the fairies who rule an underground realm, which can be accessed under the ground, probably going through a hill of some kind. And in that realm, time moves differently compared to our world. So there's always this feature of time moving slightly differently. They would have told you that these are beings who have magical powers, and they will sometimes be willing to share those magical powers with human beings if the right preparations are made or the right they're asked in the correct way, or if you manage to find your way into fairyland at the right time. But at the same time, the fairies also cause trouble for people, especially for their children. Mm-hmm. For example, they might leave a changeling and abduct a child, leaving this replica of the child that is not the real child in its place. Or they might cause childhood illnesses, and therefore you might need to go to the fairy doctor. That is to say, somebody who claims to have power to speak to the fairies, communicate with the fairies, avert these kind of illnesses, and so forth. This is the basic kind of mythology of fairies that we find at the beginning of the 16th century. It's the kind of mythology of fairies that feeds into Midsummer Night's Dream. Mm-hmm. So the king and queen of the fairies might be very beautiful, but fairies themselves can be quite ugly. They can be diminutive, I would call them, but not tiny. So they certainly are, they're about 4 feet tall, maybe 3 feet tall. Mm-hmm. They're sort of the size of small children. They're not absolutely tiny. And they certainly cannot fly, and they do not have wings. Much later. But they do dance. They love dancing by moonlight. So by the 16th century, people were explaining fairy rings that you get in the fields, patches of very verdant grass or disappeared grass, which in reality is caused by fungus, but this is explained in the 16th century in terms of fairies dancing. So that seems to be quite an old belief. They dance in circles. Basically the idea that the fairies are not evil, mm-hmm. but you probably don't want to mess with them.
Right.
You probably don't want to get very near them in the same way that you don't want to get very near wild animals, because bad things might happen to you because they are not to be relied upon and they're not to be trusted.
Right. And then you mentioned at the very end of your book, the relationship, there's a lot of people draw the relationship between UFOs like in America and fairy beliefs. And you actually had an interesting take on that. And I want you to kind of explain the relationship there.
Yes. I mean, this is a belief that goes back to Jacques Vallée, who wrote a book called Journey to Magonia, which is essentially arguing that UFOs, extraterrestrials, that mythology is fairies appearing in a different guise, mm-hmm. a different form. I have a bit of an issue with that because I think that people say it a lot. You know, people say, oh, you know, UFOs, extraterrestrials are just the fairies of our time. They're just that mythology translated into a different form. But I think that springs from ignorance of the actual specifics of fairy belief.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the theme of abduction is present in both, but there isn't really a theme, certainly within UFO abduction narratives in the sort of English-speaking world, of children being specifically targeted. It's mostly adults who
have
been abducted by aliens. So that doesn't fit. And the fact that the aliens come from the sky, again, the fact that fairies come from the earth, it's not just an accidental feature. It's a fundamental feature of who and what they are.
Mm-hmm.
They are beings of the earth. You know, that goes way, way back in the perception of fairies. It's not something you can suddenly change and say, oh, now they're coming out high. It makes no cultural sense for a transition that dramatic to take place. On the other hand, I think the idea of extraterrestrials of being human-like but not human, that idea of things that are not quite human, you know, but also having powers beyond us, mm-hmm. is kind of disturbing. I think there are elements there which you can say, yeah, you know, there are certain similarities. But I don't think they are the same folkloric phenomena. I don't think you can say that because, yeah, they're just too different.
I wonder if it has to do with, you know, because medieval Christians would associate land spirits maybe close to demonic, maybe not quite, you know, at the same level as demonic, but there is some parallel there. And we don't have that frame of reference in America. And so, and there's also this sort of utopian progressive idea. It was popular, you know, in the 70s and 80s with the aliens being salvific messiahs, you know, coming down and giving us technology. More, I think it has more maybe along the lines of like the ancient pagan gods, you know, giving technology, like Prometheus giving technology, you know, dangerous technology to humans. There may be more of a relationship there than with the tying it specifically to fairies. Because there, like you said, there are similarities. And UFO stories also, you know, a lot of Christians will say, oh, there's just demons, you know. And I'm like, well, I mean, demons don't, like, this isn't like the MO of demons either. It's not like, there's similarities there too, you know, but it's not quite the same. And so it's, they're kind of this weird, it's this weird, mishmash and twists on a bunch of these different stories, where it just like with fairies, it doesn't quite fit, you know, there's these things that don't fit. Yeah. So I don't, I thought it was fascinating.
What I would compare our current situation to is a bit like the situation in the 12th century in Britain. In the 12th century, you had all these kind of Anglo-Saxon ideas of otherworld beings that were floating around,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time were being sort of suppressed by Norman culture, and the Normans brought their own ideas, and this stuff was all fusing together. And it took a while for it all to kind of settle down and work itself out. And I think it's a bit like that. And the most you can say when you encounter tales from the 12th century, weird encounters with otherworld beings, you just have to say these are otherworld beings, like the Green Children of Woolpit, or mm-hmm. the Wild Man of Orford, or Malakin, who's this invisible poltergeist-type spirit. And it's just all weird weird and all individual and all sui generis. It's sort of, you can't generalize about it.
Yeah.
And I think this is true of, yeah, the UFO mythology, which has developed very, very rapidly since the kind of 1950s.
Right.
Understandably, I think it's still in flux and it hasn't yet kind of solidified into, and it hasn't integrated with other beliefs that people have. But then, yeah, the collapse of organized religion doesn't really help in that regard because it needs nothing for it to kind of, you know, nothing to tame it, if you like.
Right. Yeah. Yep. That's the, it's an interesting relationship between the folkloric beliefs of, you know, the more common people. And then you have like the priests and bishops and stuff who kind of put, they kind of keep it in check, you know, to an extent where it's like, yeah, you don't sacrifice, you know, stuff to these beings, because then you'll have to do all this many years of penance, and, you know, don't go in for superstition and stuff like that. But then, you know, there was never like a really serious crackdown on it, because they, like you said, they were viewed as largely unimportant. They didn't have a cult, they didn't have a priest, and even they didn't have a large pagan following. They just kind of existed, and, you know, but there wasn't like a danger where necessarily where the Christians are going to start just being idolatrous, because there never was an idolatrous relationship to them. Right. So it's very, very interesting. So it's a fascinating book. So I guess I have three questions left. What should we as Christians take away from belief in fairies? Like, is it important? And then, you know, I kind of talked about C.S. Lewis's commentary on them with the medieval model. So what should we take away from this? Is there something to take away?
I think there is a sense of wonder at the enchantment of the world. And I think that, it does matter to me that people used to live in a world that was much more enchanted than our own.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not to say that anybody should believe in fairies but I think there is a beauty to what the human spirit is capable of, in terms of, you know, what people are capable of believing, and the way in which they can make their experience of reality so animated by the presence of the spiritual. And you know, I think we've so far lost that, that the idea that we can recover some sense of the spiritual as permeating the entirety of our lived experience is something which I wish we could recover in whatever way that that's possible. I wouldn't take from it anything instructive necessarily. Improving. I don't think there's anything improving about these beliefs, but they do remind us what we've lost.
I agree. Yeah, there's nothing like didactic to take from it necessarily, but it does make a difference when you're walking out in the woods if you think that there are spirits out there or not, you know, just in your everyday lived experience. So what for further reading, what would you recommend? I know you referenced Catherine Briggs a number of times. What would you recommend other people if they want to learn more, you know, about this topic?
Yeah,
what would you recommend?
If you're interested in taking this further, I strongly recommend a book about medieval fairies, which is by Richard Firth Green, which is called Elf Queens and Holy Friars. I would recommend a book that is just about to come out by a folklorist called Jeremy Hart, which is called Medieval Fairies, which will be very good because he's a very, very fine folklorist. If you're interested in the Roman religion side of things, there's a book by Miranda Oldhouse Green, which is called Britannia Sacra, which is about the various religions that were practiced in Roman Britain, which is something that I'm very interested in. There's quite a big literature on fairies in the early modern era. I mean, mainly because of Shakespeare.
Yeah, right.
Shakespeare wrote about fairies. But that's a bit beyond the scope of the book. And in terms of Catherine Briggs, I mean, she wrote numerous books. Her Encyclopedia of Fairies is wonderful. That was one of her last books, where she tries to categorize all of the fairies of the British Isles. There isn't a huge amount of good stuff that's written about fairies. But yeah, where you do encounter it, it's best to stick with the good stuff rather than all the nonsense that's out there.
Yeah, it's kind of a dangerous subject, you know, because there's a lot of new age stuff, there's a lot of, like, you know, Wiccan stuff, and, you know, so it's hard to separate the good from the bad. But your book has tons of references to, like, Ronald Hutton, and, you know, any serious academic would probably be, not any, but, you know, you reference a number of very serious academics in there who I think would be worth reading. So, excellent. So I have one more question for you, and it's a question I ask every guest. And it might seem redundant given the topic, but this show is called I Might Believe in Fairies. Because as we've discussed, I'm open to the idea, right? And I'm a Catholic, so I have, you know, the standard Orthodox beliefs of angels and demons, and the fairies are something that, or godlings, I should say. Maybe I should rename it I Might Believe in Godlings. That's something that I'm agnostic about, and I find them fascinating. So I want to know if you, Dr. Francis Young, do you believe in godlings, not just as an experiential or cultural phenomenon, but do you believe in them as actual beings?
I think I'd give a very similar answer to the one that you've given. I would say that it's something on which you can only be agnostic, I think, because
right.
they're beings for whose evidence we don't have, you know, any real evidence that they exist, and we also don't have an unambiguous testimony in terms of doctrine and magisterium that they exist. But on the other hand, I think that the possibility that the spiritual world is a complex ecosystem of life, like the physical world, to me makes sense.
Yeah.
Personally. You know, when we look at the variety of the biological world, the sheer astonishing kind of unnecessary variety, as it seems to us, the kind of the outpouring of God's creative energy, does it make sense that the spiritual world could also be like that? That there are all these beings, that this is complex ecosystem. It does make sense.
Yeah.
Now, how we make sense of that, I don't know. But I'm open. I'm open to the possibility that there are more things in heaven and earth than we have dreamt of.
That is an excellent response, and that's kind of what I. I didn't want to infer your beliefs, you know, from reading the book, but I thought maybe it would be something similar to that. So, yeah, excellent. Well, thank you, Dr. Young. This has been really fun, and I want to dive into Magic in Merlin's Realm next, and I know you have other books coming out. I think one on Lithuania, is that right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So we'll keep an eye out. I don't know, what was that one called? Is that
I've got one coming up, which is a translation of three epic poems that were written in the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. So it's called Poetry and Nation Building in the Grand Duchy of Lithuania.
Excellent, excellent. Well, do you have any final thoughts?
I think we've covered everything.
Sounds good. All right, well, thank you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you are excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.